Good afternoon. I'd like to call this meeting in the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order. The time is now 1:34 p.m. We're in Belts, Room 105 at the Thomas Stewart Building in the nation's most beautiful capital city of Juneau, Alaska. Today is Monday, March 30th, 2026. Members present are Senator Gray Jackson, Senator Merrick, Senator Dunbar, and myself, Senator Bjorkman. Senator Yunt is excused for today. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Welcome everyone to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please turn off or silence your cell phones and join me in welcoming our recording secretary, Carrie Tupo, and our LAO moderator, Jude Augustine. We have three items on our agenda today. First up is SGR 28, supporting J-1 and H-1B visa programs. Following that will be Senate Bill 217, employer contributions. Last up is Senate Bill 258, contract licensing software applications. First, we will take up SGR 28, which was on our agenda last week, but while hearing another bill, it quickly became apparent that we would not have time for SGR 28, so we put that bill on the top of our agenda today. With us for a presentation of the bill, we have staff to the Honorable Senator Luke Yale-Tobin, Mr. Mike Mason. Mr. Mason, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your presentation of the bill.
Good afternoon. My name is Mike Mason. I am staff to Senator Luke Yale-Tobin. She chairs the Senate Education Committee, and I get to serve as the committee aide. Senator Tobin apologizes for not being here today. She's in another committee meeting at the moment. The resolution that is before you recognizes the important role that visa programs, such as the J-1 visa program and the H-1B program, play in the economy and the education of children and young adults across Alaska. As you will hear from our invited testifiers, visa workers are vital to filling Alaska's diverse workforce needs. Foreign worker visa programs are extremely useful for highly seasonal industries such as tourism. Alaska has the largest seasonal employment swing in the country, with a gap of about 43,900 jobs between the lowest and the highest employment months. Visitor-related industries employ 68,300 workers in 2024, and some of the most seasonal components, including accommodations and scenic and sightseeing transportation, rely heavily on workers that come from outside of Alaska during peak seasons. This is not a marginal fluctuation. It is a structural feature of our economy. There is public testimony document in your packet from Marilyn Usabelli. She and her family own and operate the Black Diamond Resort Company in Healy. She notes that, and I'm quoting here, despite extensive local recruitment, the small year-round population in the Denali borough simply cannot meet the seasonal demand. J-1 participants fill critical roles that allow us to maintain safe, high-quality operations, support other local businesses, and contribute to the broader Denali area economy. Unfortunately, in September of last year, the federal government imposed a $100,000 payment requirement for certain H-1B petitions. Previously, that fee was $5,000. This effectively ended most employers' ability to use that program to fill open jobs. As you will hear in the invited testimony from the director of the Alaska Educator Retention and Recruitment Center, the $100,000 payment requirement has made it nearly impossible for Alaska's public schools to utilize the H-1B visa program to hire new international teachers. In its 2026 report to the Alaska Legislature, the State Board of Education and Early Development reported that Alaska schools continue to benefit from the contributions of internationally recruited educators who help districts fill positions that would otherwise remain vacant. Senator Tobin contends, and I think our invited testifiers will reiterate, that legal visa programs supplement domestic hiring. They do not replace local hiring. The resolution you are considering would put the Alaska Legislature on record in support of foreign visa workers to fill unfilled jobs in the state of Alaska. Passage of the resolution would also urge Alaska's congressional delegation to work with federal policymakers to preserve and strengthen workable J-1 and H-1B pathways that support the state's unique workforce needs. Finally, I would note that Senator Tobin has invited three people to testify today. Hopefully, among the four of us, we can answer any questions that you have about the resolution and the importance of foreign visa worker programs to the Alaska economy and to the education system. And I can take any questions, or we can move on to our invited testimony. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mason. Are there any questions from committee members for Mr. Mason? Hearing and seeing none, we'll go to our first invited testifier, Mrs. Jennifer Schmitz. Mrs. Schmitz, welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Borkman and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. For the record, my name is Jennifer Schmitz. I'm the director of the Alaska Educator Retention and Recruitment Center. We are a division of the Alaska Council of School Administrators. Through ARC, we support our school districts with recruiting and retention challenges. Part of this work includes international hiring. Although we are an educational organization, I want to start by emphasizing this is not just an education issue. It's a statewide workforce issue across industries. I recently attended an event hosted by the Juneau Economic Development Council to share workforce challenges in education, and it was very evident that this is a challenge across industry and across our state. While actual numbers of visa employees across Alaska is difficult to get, we know that employers rely on visa workers to fill critical roles that cannot otherwise be staffed. These jobs include areas like seafood processing, tourism, healthcare, construction, and many other sectors. When access to these workers is restricted, Alaska's economy and communities are directly impacted. In many communities, visa workers are what keeps essential services running. Education is simply one example of how this workforce challenge is playing out and a place where we have good data. Senate Joint Resolution 28 recognizes that Alaska's workforce needs are unique and that visa access is critical across industries. I know some of you have seen this slide before, but this is a slide that's showing trends in teacher and principal turnover in the state of Alaska. I think you can see the most recent data we have from 2024 shows principal turnover at 35% as an average and teacher turnover at 28%. Same information, just spread out a little differently, shows you that, I've said before, I think 10 years ago it was a lot easier to find teachers in our urban areas and rural remote might have been a little bit more of an issue. But now it's about the same as far as teachers trying to find and get those positions filled. Principals are a little more challenging in the rural areas. Put this slide in here because this is national data, and it really shows that we are up against a lot of challenges as far as recruitment and retention, and one of them for education, and one of those is that we have a teacher shortage across the country. In 2005, around 10,000 positions were short, and projections for 2025, I don't have the data, but was at least 200,000 short teachers. So we used to get a lot of teachers from Alaska and from other states, and we have a very hard time doing that today. So this is the Alaska breakdown. The first box, 345 unfilled first-day teaching positions. When school started this year in the state of Alaska, there were 345 classrooms that did not have teachers ready to go at the beginning of the year. We do have 573 teachers that are currently working on visas, and we've got some great international teachers really helping across the state. They're doing a great job. We also had 285 emergency certificates the first day. Those are district-sponsored certificates that districts can say, we don't have a teacher, and we're going to put somebody in there that may or may not be qualified at that time. We would like this to have all zeros across it. We would like the first day of school to have no vacancies. Even though our international teachers are doing really well for us in our communities, we would love to be filling our classrooms with teachers that were from Alaska first and across the country. We're just not able to do that. And, of course, we would rather have no emergency certificates. International hiring, just for our state, is we have currently 232 teachers on J-1 visas and 340 on H-1B visas. The challenge right now with the proclamation of $100,000 on H-1Bs is very real for education. And one of the reasons that it is so real is the J-1 or the federal, at the federal level, the J-1 sponsoring agencies have been told that they can't place J-1 teachers in rural Alaska anymore. So many of our districts that were hiring J-1 teachers are no longer able to do that. So H-1B is really the only option if they're off the road system. And no districts can afford that cost of that $100,000.
Mrs. Schwartz, I have a question about a statement you made So who is restricting the placement of J-1 visa holders in rural Alaska, and why is that happening?
So it's from the federal level, and they've told the different agencies that sponsor J-1 visas that those teachers need to be in places where there's hospitals and grocery stores and road system. And I don't know exactly why it got to that place. I believe that when you are a sponsoring agency for a J-1 visa, you have to be able to go visit the teachers and check in on them. And it's more of just a cultural exchange instead of a job placement. And so the agencies are responsible for their well-being, and I think that they just feel like it's maybe not the best place.
Understood. Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you so much for your presentation. Can you tell us the difference between a J-1 visa and an H-1B? Thank you.
Absolutely. Through the chair. Yes, a J-1 visa is more of a cultural exchange where the person comes over and they're learning, their country is thinking, they're coming over and they're learning about education, if I'm talking about education specifically, learning about education in Alaska, learning about education in the U.S., to then go back to their home countries and use what they've learned to make the teaching there better. And the H-1B is really just more of a working visa where they can go work somewhere else.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. I won't read all of these facts, but these are some of the H-1B facts in Alaska, and I really focus on that last one. We're worried right now. I mean, we have a lot of openings, as we did last year. This is the time that we have to be hiring teachers if we want them here, international teachers. If we want them here by the first day of school, we need to be hiring them yesterday, and this proclamation is really making that difficult to do so. And I think I already talked about this for the most part, but we are not able to put J-1 teachers. Our larger districts, Anchorage and Fairbanks, still rely on J-1 visa teachers for their positions, but everybody else is really having to look at H-1Bs. And then it's always fun for an educator to show pictures of teachers and students, and so I wanted to do that. The middle picture is a teacher in the Yukon Koyukuk School District. She's been there for 5 years on a J-1 visa. She's ending her time there. These are her students. They went to the superintendent and asked if they could get passports to go home with her because they don't want her to leave. Our international teachers are filling roles that would otherwise, or positions that would otherwise be open, and they're really offering a lot to our communities, and we really appreciate that this resolution could help that. Senate Joint Resolution 28 recognizes that Alaska's workforce, the realities of it, and supports continued access to our international workers across education and other industries, and so we hope that you will support it. Thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Schmitz. Are there any questions from committee members? Hearing and seeing none, thank you once again for joining us at Senate Labor and Commerce today. We'll go next to Victoria Francis. Ms. Francis, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Victoria Francis. I'm the Deputy Director of State and Local Initiatives at the American Immigration Council. The American Immigration Council works to create a more welcoming America, one that provides a fair immigration process for new Americans and adopts policies that consider the vital contributions immigrants make to the U.S. economy. I'm here in support of Senate Joint Resolution 28, and to highlight the importance of the J-1 Exchange Visitor Program, as well as the H-1B High-Skilled Visa Program, both of which play a critical role in shaping and supporting the U.S. and Alaskan economies and strengthening local workforces. At the American Immigration Council, we work directly with employers across the country through our Global Talent Chamber Network, comprised of over 90 chambers of commerce, and through 3 statewide business coalitions that promote the interests of the business community through immigration and workforce policy. Additionally, through the Council's Cultural Exchange Program, we sponsor J-1 visa interns, trainees, and research scholars at host organizations across the country. We have brought more than 500 international J-1 visitors to the United States, where participants contribute directly to U.S. workforces while also building bridges across cultures. Through these programs and our ongoing engagement with business leaders, we consistently hear the same message. Programs like J1 and H1B are essential tools for meeting workforce needs and keeping businesses running. The J1 program is fundamentally about meeting economic needs while also fostering cultural exchange. It brings students, researchers, teachers, interns, and seasonal workers to communities across the U.S., including Alaska, as you just heard, where they support industries like tourism, hospitality, education, and research that are central but often difficult to staff locally. Between 2015 and 2025, Alaska welcomed nearly 23,000 J1 participants, averaging about 3,900 per year. These participants are not permanent immigrants competing broadly across labor markets. They are carefully selected temporary visitors who must demonstrate appropriate education or training, English proficiency, and an intent to return home after their program concludes. The J1 program operates under rigorous federal oversight by the Department of State, with designated sponsors responsible for monitoring compliance, ensuring participant safety, and enforcing program rules. At the same time, the J1 program fills a different but equally essential role by allowing employers to hire highly educated professionals in specialized fields such as technology, engineering, and healthcare, where domestic labor shortages are well documented. Research shows that foreign workers complement rather than replace U.S. workers, help companies expand, increase productivity, and support job creation across the broader economy, while also contributing significantly to innovation, entrepreneurship, as well as federal, state, and local tax revenue. In fact, H-1B workers may actually increase the employment opportunity for U.S. foreign workers, keeping unemployment rates relatively low in occupations that employ large numbers of H-1B visa workers. After a September 2025 presidential proclamation, employers will now be required to pay one-time $100,000 fee per new H-1B visa petition. Previously, it cost employers usually between $2,000 to $5,000 per petition, depending on the size of their company. This new policy is prohibitively expensive for small and medium-sized employers and school districts, including K-12 and higher education institutions, healthcare providers, and companies involved in mining, quarrying, and oil and gas extraction, where a lot of H-1B visa workers have supported the Alaska economy in the past. In fact, fewer than 90 companies have opted to pay the $100,000 fee since it was announced. This further demonstrates how companies are being priced out of accessing workers they need through this program. Additionally, in October of 2025, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, representing about 3 million businesses across the U.S., filed a lawsuit challenging the $100,000 H-1B visa. They cited that, quote, the new $100,000 fee will make it cost prohibitive for U.S. employers, especially startups and small businesses and mid-sized businesses, to utilize the H-1B program, which was created by Congress expressly to ensure that American businesses of all sizes can access global talent they need to grow their operations here in the United States. Together, the J-1 and H-1B programs still help fill workforce gaps. They support vital U.S. industries and ensure that American businesses can compete globally, but they are increasingly at risk from policy changes and restrictions that can limit access, disrupt workforce pipelines, and drive talent and investment to other countries. When these programs become harder to access, whether through increased costs, administrative barriers, or inefficiencies, businesses struggle to find workers, innovation slows, and economic opportunities are lost. Alongside with the spending power, economic activity, taxes paid, and other contributions these workers make to local economies and communities. That's why I am here today to urge you to vote in favor of Senate Joint Resolution 28 and its affirmation of the value of these programs and their importance to the Alaskan economy. Thank you for your time today. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Francis. Senator Dunbar has a question for you. And if you have like a handset on your phone, if you could pick that up instead of being on speakerphone if you are, that would be amazing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask – thank you, Ms. Francis. I wanted to ask about the court case and where it was when we first got this resolution. I was thinking in my – I was just thinking – I'm just very surprised that the authorizing statute gives the executive this kind of power. It's clearly not for, you know, administrative costs. It's an additional $95,000 or whatever it is per person. And I don't recall Congress passing a statute to this effect. So I'm glad to hear the Chamber of Commerce filed a lawsuit. Is there currently an injunction on enforcing this fee, or can you give us any more information about where that lawsuit is or any other lawsuits on this topic?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, that's a great question. It was enjoined, so it was blocked by the court, but so it's being on – the litigation is ongoing. It has essentially become a question of whether or not this is considered a tax or a fee. So right now there is a requirement to pay that $100,000.
Follow-up.
Senator Dunbar.
So, I'm sorry, that answer confused me a little bit. So if the actions by the administration are enjoined, why is the $100,000 required?
Oh, sorry. My apologies. It is not enjoined. It is
enjoined.
It is not enjoined. The fee is still in place. Apologies.
Okay.
That was confusing.
Okay. Well, it's disappointing to hear. I hope it is appealed. I just don't understand how the authorizing statute would allow what is clearly a very significant change in policy and is something approaching a tax, not an administrative fee. So hopefully that is resolved, but that doesn't change the fact in my mind that we should make our voice heard on this topic. But I suspect that's where, like many things with administration, that's where it's going to be resolved. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Dunbar. Any further questions for Mrs. Francis? Seeing and hearing none, we'll go to our last invited testifier, Mrs. Emily Dimel. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Emily Dimel. I'm from the Philippines, and I have been teaching in Alaska for the past 4 years. I'm currently a teacher in Apascat, and I'm here today to speak in strong support of SJR 28. In rural Alaska, the teacher shortage is not just something we read about. It is our daily reality. To keep our classrooms open and functioning, many of our school districts rely heavily on international educators through the H-1B and J-1 visa programs. These teachers are not supplemental. They are essential. In my own school district, LKSD, roughly 30 to 35% of our teachers are international hires. This is not by choice, but by necessity. Without them, many of our classrooms simply would not have a teacher. However, the $100,000 fee per worker imposed last year has created an overwhelming financial burden, making it nearly impossible for districts like mine to continue recruiting and retaining the qualified educators our students need and deserve. To put this into perspective, in some neighboring rural districts such as the Bering Strait School District, nearly 40% of the teaching staff are international educators. In Prodia, approximately 75% of village teachers are internationally hired. These individuals are not replacing anyone. They are filling critical positions that would otherwise remain vacant. In small rural schools like ours, losing even one or two teachers can mean significantly larger class sizes, reduced course offerings, and fewer opportunities for our students to succeed. SJR 28 represents an important step toward addressing this issue. It supports federal legislation introduced by Senator Murkowski that keeps to exempt qualified teachers from this prohibitive fees. This is a practical, common sense solution that acknowledges the unique challenges faced by rural Alaskan communities. As a teacher working directly with students in Apascat, I witness every day the dedication, compassion, and commitment that international educators bring to our schools. They are deeply invested in our communities and in our students' success. We simply cannot afford to lose them. I respectfully urge the committee to pass SJR 28 to help protect our students, support our educators, and secure a brighter future for our students. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Dimel. Are there any questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, I believe a committee member has a question for Mr. Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Mason, thank you for being here. I notice in your backup documentation you have an article that refers to the H-2B visa, and I'm curious what that is and why it's not included in this resolution, please.
Mike Mason, staff to Senator Lukey Yeltobin. Quite frankly, we actually could add that phrase to this. So the Alaska seafood sector has long used temporary foreign visa workers to fill fill jobs. Unfortunately, federal restrictions that were implemented back in 2013 made it impossible for the Alaska seafood industry to use that J-1 visa program. Many people in the commercial fishing industry are very familiar that J-1s were used in the processing sector across the state. And what happened was food manufacturers were excluded from the program. There was, quite frankly, I think there were some abuses of that program that were being conducted in some of the large processing facilities, essentially it was the Hershey program in Hershey, Pennsylvania, was misusing the J-1 visa program. So there were some changes that were made to that program at that point. In recent years, many seafood processors have been using the H-2B visa program, which allows employers to bring foreign workers to the U.S. to fill temporary non-agricultural jobs during shortages. The visas are actually issued through a lottery system. UNICE started using the H-2B program back in 2019, but there is currently a cap of 66,000 H-2B visas per year. And so that cap has made it where a lot of seafood processors have started to not use that program because they are trying to fill – essentially the cap prevents them from adding more visa workers. So there's a – these programs are very useful for the Alaska economy, but they seem to be – they're being capped. There's the fees that are being placed on them. So it's being – they're being made very challenging to be used now in the state of Alaska.
Thank you.
Very well. Any further questions? Seeing, hearing none, any wrap-up comments today, Mr. Mason?
I just want to thank you all for taking the time out of your very busy schedule and the other bills that you've got in front of you to consider this. As someone that covered the fishing industry in the state of Alaska, and as someone that is trying to pay attention to what's happening in public education today, these foreign workers they don't really compete with our local workers. They simply add to the labor force, and we've got shortages across the state. And I think that these programs are vital to the Alaska economy, and we should not hamstring them as we are right now as a nation. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mason. If members would like to amend this resolution vis-a-vis an amendment or a committee substitute, we'd be happy to take that up at a future hearing. So open to all suggestions there. At this time, we will set SJR 28 aside for further consideration at a future hearing. We'll take a brief at ease while we set up for the next bill. back on the record, it's 2:05 p.m. here in Senate Labor and Commerce. Our next item up today is Senate Bill 217. For a brief recap of the bill, we have Director Paloma Harbor with the Employment and Training Services, as well as Lennon Weller from the UI Actuarial Economist section for a brief recap of the bill. Welcome back to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please put yourselves on the record and provide us a brief recap of a little bit of where we've been and where we might go.
Thank you, Chair Bjorkman. For the record, Paloma Harbor, Director for the Division of Employment and Training Services with the Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
Again, good afternoon. Chairman Bjorkman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lennon Weller. I'm an economist for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development in the Research and Analysis section, and I function as the actuary for the unemployment insurance system.
Thank you again for hearing Senate Bill 217 and inviting us back to present some information on clarifying what the current version of the bill does and what other options might be for the committee. This first slide clarifies some things on the employee taxes. I heard there was some confusion after the last hearing on what is happening with employee taxes. In current statute, without any change, employees pay a minimum tax of 0.5% already on covered wages. Of that, an equivalent tax of 0.25% goes to the Training and Vocational Education Program. 0.1% goes to the State Training and Employment Program. And the remaining 0.15% goes to the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. What the committee substitute that the committee adopted last week, version N, does is it increases the employee contribution to the State Training and Employment Program to 0.2% and reduces the contribution to unemployment insurance remaining from the employee tax to just 0.05%. Now, the committee asked us to run some scenarios, and we're going to talk through those on the coming slides. Those scenarios, number 3 and 4, would eliminate that minimal tax that's still going to the UI Trust Fund and result on an overall reduction on the tax burden to employees of 0.05%. Any questions? Okay. So as I mentioned, the committee requested some scenarios. The first scenario is a baseline scenario, no changes. The second scenario is the current committee substitute version N, which increases the maximum weekly benefit amount to $525. The third scenario is a reduction in that maximum weekly benefit amount to $470 with annual adjustments and that change in employee taxes that I talked about on the previous slide. And then scenario 4 is the current version of the bill with an annual adjustment to the maximum weekly benefit and that employee tax change that I talked about. This slide shows the trust fund reserve ratio projected out through 2040. I lost my years there. Sorry about that. So what this shows is that the health of the trust fund, the target solvency rate reserve ratio, is between 3 and 3.3% of wages. And so I've bolded that line here. The statutory target minimum is 3%. And in a baseline scenario, without any change, our trust fund would go up to over 11% by 2040, whereas all three of the models bring it more into alignment with where it should be in that 3 to 3.3% range. So that's what this slide shows. The next slide, all I did was remove that baseline so that you could see the nuances between those reserve ratio projections and the three models, the current version of the bill, the 470 with an annual adjustment, and the 525 with an annual adjustment. One of the things, the reason I wanted to zoom in on this is because, as I mentioned, the target reserve ratio is 3 to 3.3%, but because that employee tax is being diverted from the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund and going into the training funds, but the statutes don't know that, right? The way the current tax structure is built is it anticipates that employees are contributing 27% of the cost, but so much of that is going to training programs that the trust fund's collecting less than it thinks it's going to, which is bringing in this scenario number two, bringing the reserve ratio below that target statutory range of 3 to 3.3%. So that's what the cleanup on the employee tax fixes, if you choose to do that. Any questions on that? Okay. So this slide shows the benefit cost projections, again, from 2027 through 2040, under those three different models. 525 maximum weekly benefit with no annual increase. That's the purple line here. Red line. the 470 maximum weekly benefit amount increased by inflation over this time frame and how it eventually gets to that same level by 2040 in benefit total benefit costs. And then the 525 with an annual adjustment and where that gets to by 2040. Okay. I should have mentioned that the annual adjustment we're talking about is tied to the wages, the increase in wages year over year. So as wages increase in the state, the benefit, maximum weekly benefit amount would increase. So this slide here shows the state training employment program projections in each of the scenarios that we've spoken about. You'll see that without an annual adjustment to the maximum weekly benefit, the contributions to the STEP program from employers would stay at a higher level as you increase benefit costs by increasing the benefit, the annual draw, and as you reduce the employee contribution. Employers do have to contribute more rapidly, so there's less high years of STEP contributions. So that's what this chart shows you. Okay. This last chart shows you the average employer tax total between unemployment insurance and STEP. Again, baseline. 1% is what's in current statute as a statutory minimum tax on average or total for employers. And then under this legislation, that would be reduced to a minimum of 0.4% going to STEP or UI, depending on what the solvency of the trust fund is. And then as more is needed to cover the costs of the trust fund, that tax rate would increase. But again, on average, it would still be below the current statutory minimum by 2040. Okay. Because it gets lost in the nuance, there are, again, 21 rate classes in statute. We, when we're presenting, focus on the average, which is rate classes 10 and 11. But employers that experience more fluctuations in wages would pay a higher tax rate than those that experience a lower fluctuation in wages. So we wanted to show what the impact would be by each of those rate classes under each of these scenarios. So this is the current version of the bill. This is a flat wage cost or maximum weekly benefit cost without annual adjustment and no change to employee contributions. And you'll see how the tax rates change over time under the current projections. The second scenario here is with the current version of the bill's maximum weekly benefit amount of 525 adjusted annually and the change to the employee tax. And you'll see again how taxes by class change over time. By 2040, the highest rate classes are paying more than that average of 1% that they're currently paying, but a modest amount more. This last slide is, again, that weekly benefit amount of 470 with an annual adjustment and the employee tax rate change. And again, by 2040, that highest rate class is just getting to the 1%. Any questions? That concludes my presentation.
Thank you very much, Director Harbor. Senator Dunbar.
Question for you, Mr. Chair, and then for the presenters. So I'm trying to track the different CSs here. We're currently on version N, or are we on version I?
Yeah, so I'll scope this out, really, what the information we're getting in options before us. So currently we have version I before the committee as a working document. Version I has in it a maximum weekly benefit. I'm sorry, version N. Yes. Version N. I misspoke. Version N is currently before the committee as a working document.
Yeah.
And version N has a maximum weekly benefit of 525, but it's not indexed to anything. It's just a flat increase. Mm-hmm. As we looked at the charts that we saw during the last presentation on this bill, that left little room for any other options that the body might want to consider as we look at potentially adding paid parental leave or other programs from the UI Trust Fund. So, or reducing taxes on the employee side by 0.05%, as is contemplated in version I, which may be before the committee in a minute. So as we're looking at options, I asked the department to model what these things would look like, and specifically, if we took the adjustment to the maximum weekly benefit based on the increase of the wage base. So if the maximum weekly benefit were to float with the wage base instead of inflation, what would that look like? And then what other options are on the table for further utilization of the unemployment insurance fund? And so it's a policy call as to what is it that we would like to do. Basically, trying to point out here that if we run the maximum weekly benefit up to 525 per week, mm-hmm. you have less options and less on the table to make further policy decisions with in the future, especially if you desire to do other things. So that's really where we're at. That's kind of how I think it's important to look at this in the scope of the choices that are before us. So.
Yeah, I'm looking at slide 2 versus slide 4, and I think I understand what you're saying, Mr. Chair. So it's not the elimination of the 0.05% effective tax on the employee that drives the projection sort of underwater under that 3%, but rather primarily driven by the maximum weekly benefit amount. Is that right? If you look at scenario 2, because that's in that's version N that's still maintaining that 0.05%. I'm trying to understand scenario 3 and 4. I guess those are also both version N. So I thought that they had modeled version I, but it looks like that they haven't, at least not there. Yeah, I don't see any modeling of version I according to these labels. Have you modeled version I?
Again, for the record, Paloma Harbor, through the chair, Senator Dunbar. Version I would be equivalent to scenario 3.
The one that says version N?
Yes. It's version N with a change in the maximum weekly benefit amount to $470 a week, uh-huh. and an annual adjustment based on the change in wages in the state and the change to the employee taxes. All of that's in version I. But okay. At the time, we didn't know that that was a version that was coming before the committee.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dunbar.
So what's the mechanism in version I that decides whether you're in scenario 3 or scenario 4? Where's the section?
Through,
language?
Oh, through the chair, Senator Dunbar, it is the maximum weekly benefit amount that you start with in Section 4 of Version N. So in Section 4 of Version N on page 10, the maximum weekly benefit amount is $525. And you could either start at that level and adjust annually based on change in wages, or you could go back as proposed under Version I to $470 and increase it annually from there.
Section 4, Version N, starting on what page again?
Page 10 is where Section 4 ends.
It's where it ends.
Mm-hmm. And you'll see the 525.
Let's see. So for Version I, then, mm-hmm. is it Scenario 3 or Scenario 4? I still don't understand what the mechanism is that puts you in one version or the other in Scenario 3 or Scenario 4.
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, it's where you decide as a committee that this wage maximum weekly benefit amount schedule starts in 2027. Does it start at 470 or does it start at 525?
Okay, so let's look into Version I then. What is it currently set at? That is to say, what is the language in I have us doing? It looks like it has it running up to 470. Okay.
Yes.
So it's 470. So that is so it's Scenario 3 then.
That's correct.
That keeps it solvent. Is there any version that both keeps us at 470 and maintains the 0.05? And I only ask that because we're solvent, but we're very close to the line there.
Go on. No, you finish your question. I'm sorry.
Well, I think I am done with my question. Is there any version of this that allows us to maintain the 0.05 and the 470, and then, as the chair said, has flexibility to do something else like parental leave or whatever?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, what we were trying to articulate is you can maintain the 0.05 employee tax. You can do that. But the statutes are written in a way where the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund thinks it's getting more than that. It thinks it's getting more than 0.05. So that's why it's coming down below the 3% here. And in a case where you're trying to maintain solvency, it actually doesn't collect as much as it wants unless you clean up the employee tax statutes, because it's expecting more from the employee than it's actually getting.
Follow, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Does Version I eliminate the 0.05?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, yes, it does.
Okay. So there's no version N or I that does kind of what I asked, which is like both has that 470 and maintains the 0.05. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. All right. Those are all the questions I have for now, Mr. Chair. I think I understand what we're doing.
Thank you. Either Director Harbor or Mr. Weller, could you talk the committee and the public through why it is that there needs to be some cleanup on what the UI Trust Fund is expecting versus what it's getting, and then how the elimination of that 0.05% tax helps bring that into alignment and makes the modeling work?
Again, for the record, Lennon Weller. Chair Bjorkman, so to kind of back up to kind of the base of how we calculate UI tax rates in a given year. We look at costs as a percentage of wages on a three-year moving basis. And this sets the base rate for what we need to collect in order to recapture what was paid out. Again, as a percentage of wages that were covered, what was paid out. This is what's referred to as this average benefit cost rate. So once we've calculated this rate, we apportion 73% of that value to employers and the remaining 27% to employees in statute explicitly. Again, currently with those minimums of 1% for an employer, 0.5% for the employee. The next step in rates regarding employers is if there's a solvency adjustment needed. So when the fund finds itself outside of that range of 3.3 to 3%, we either add on a surcharge if it's below 3% or actually provide a credit of some level if we're above that. Again, with the stipulation that we can't charge less than 1% for an employer, 0.5% for employees. So what happens on the cost recapture portion of the calculation is that when once the fund, once the system rebalances to back into target statutory range, ideally you're collecting just what you need to cut to recapture costs. But if what you're getting is only 73% plus that remaining 0.05%, if we're using version N's example, that you're actually shortchanging the system in terms of what it's expecting to get to just recapture costs. Again, we're setting aside solvency targets, but just the cost recapture. So what happens is you end up with chronically underfunding the system in terms of cost recapture. And what can happen is eventually solvency adjustments can try to make up for that in future years, but it's a timing issue, and it creates a distortion in the system that's certainly, I think, more evident once the system rebalances. And that's essentially what's happening in all of these scenarios other than the baseline scenario, because two big factors. The single biggest one is that you're allowing that statutory minimum to come down to zero for the employer, meaning that you're actually trying to meet your exact needs for costs. And so once the system starts to actually be able to reduce tax rates, primarily because the balance of the trust fund is where it is currently, a percentage point and a half higher than target, you're essentially rebalancing the system. So where this shows itself is once the system gets back into balance, back into target ranges, you then find yourself collecting less than what you need to, because on the employee side, you're diverting, again, if we're using version N, 90% of what you're expecting to get from the employee. And so therefore, you're only getting around 77% of what you're expecting to, based again on that cost recapture. And then the system can respond to that in later years, but it creates a mismatch in terms of timing and something that it has to adjust to that's inefficient and not, it's not very clear.
Director Harbor.
Thank you, Chair Bjorkman. Just again, Paloma Harbor for the record. As Lennon mentioned, and you'll see it here, if it's underfunded in a year based on the significant portion of the employee contribution going into training programs instead of the trust fund, as he mentioned at the very end, that gets adjusted through trust fund solvency adjustments that are wholly applied to the employer in future years. So it's a delayed effect, which is most concerning when we're in an economic downturn, right? It's not as concerning when the trust fund's healthy, the economy's healthy, because 3.3%, 2.85%, not a major heartburn. But when we get down to 1% during a pandemic, that delayed recapture is a significant, but could be a significant issue. Also, just to clarify, that recapture gets put 100% on the employer anyway. So starting at the beginning with just saying employers are covering the cost is just a cleaner way to go.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think, can I ask a follow-up question?
Yes.
So I think I understand what you're saying. So by eliminating the employee minimum, we're not reducing the amount of money flowing into the trust. We are instead saying that at the front end, the employer will cover all of it.
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, that is correct.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? Seeing and hearing none in members' packets is a proposed committee substitute. May I have a motion, please?
Yes, Chair Bjorkman. I move to adopt committee substitute for Senate Bill 217, version 34, GS, Gulf Sierra, 2585-I, India, as the working document.
Object for purposes of explanation. We already kind of explained the CS, which is totally fine. Is there anything else that you would like to discuss regarding the specific CS version I?
Thank you, Chair Bjorkman. Again, Paloma Harbor for the record. So just to clarify, this version of the bill takes the maximum weekly benefit amount from what it currently is of 370 and increases it to 470. It also indexes that to wages. So as wages change year over year, so does the benefit amount, so that we won't see that misalignment that's kind of happened since 2009. And as I mentioned, it clarifies employee taxes. Instead of the trust fund thinking that it's getting employee taxes that are really going to training programs, it just says employees are contributing to training programs and employers are paying for the unemployment system. So those are the changes.
Thank you very much. Are there any further questions for Director Harbor? Hearing and seeing no questions, I'll remove my objection to the CS. Is there further objection? Hearing and seeing none, committee substitute for Senate Bill 217, version I as an Iditarod, is before the committee as a working document. I'll take a brief at ease real quick. Brief at ease. We're back on the record. It's 2:33 p.m. now. Appreciate everyone's discussion and contemplation of that CS and options. We are going to set this bill aside, but please do continue to consider options before us involving the unemployment trust fund as we go forward. We'll take this bill up at a future hearing where we will hear from Director Collins about some of the work comp provisions that are in this bill. We'll take another brief at ease while we set up for our next bill, which is Senate Bill 258. Brief at ease. Back on the record, it's 2:35 p.m. now in Senate Labor and Commerce. Our final item for today is Senate Bill 258. Here to present Senate Bill 258 is staff to the Honorable Senator Jesse Keel. Honor Miller Austin. Welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce, ma'am. Put yourself on the record, and please begin your presentation of the bill.
Hello. For the record, Honor Miller Austin, staff to Senator Jesse Kiel. The senator sends his regrets for not being here today, although I will be here to present the bill for you. Thank you, Chair Brookman, and members of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee for hearing this bill today. Senate Bill 258 is a procurement bill within statute, and it is also a fair and efficient government bill. In recent years, some software licensing vendors began requiring the consumer purchaser to consent to sign a contract that moves their existing software products to preferred cloud servers instead of agencies being allowed to choose their own product that suits their needs, whether it's price, security, storage space, etc. And I think this bill in the long run lowers costs due to the competition being there. We also have Scott Drexel online. He is the state and local director with the Coalition for Fair Software Licensing for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Miller-Austin. Are there any questions from committee members? Seeing hearing none, we'll go to Mr. Scott Drexel. Mr. Drexel.
Great. Thank you very much for having me, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Again, my name is Scott Drexel. I'm here on behalf of the Coalition for Fair Software Licensing. We're an organization comprised of American companies representing a cross-section of key industries, including healthcare, financial services, manufacturing, software, and cloud and cybersecurity providers. I understand a lot of the members of the committee were on a previous committee that I testified before, so I'll try not to be too repetitive here. I think Senator Kiel's staff has been extraordinarily helpful and drilled in on the details of this legislation. So I'll keep my remarks brief to be respectful of the committee's time and leave as much for questions if necessary. So the purpose of SB 258 is very simple, and it's just to ensure that a contract entered into by a state agency for the purchase of software that's designed to run on generally available server hardware doesn't artificially restrict the state's ability to deploy that software in the infrastructure environment that best fits its particular business needs. The need for this legislation arises out of growing concern among IT leaders and procurement offices around the country that restrictive licensing practices lead to wasteful government spending. They create unnecessary cybersecurity vulnerabilities and generally hinder technology modernization efforts. Generally speaking, they lead to what's become known as vendor lock, in which purchasers of software, are effectively prevented from switching between technology service providers as circumstances necessitate. The industry standard prior to 2019 was known as bring your own license, BYOL, and under that policy, once a customer purchase software licenses, absent any technical restriction, they were free to deploy that software using the cloud or hardware environment that was most efficient to its own needs. And again, that could be a cybersecurity or cyber resilience need. That could be out of an effort to realize cost savings. But around that time, there were several large technology providers that started restricting those choices so that purchasers of software were effectively forced into purchasing additional services and goods beyond the scope of that particular contract, really just a way to use existing relationships with customers to force them to buy things they may or may not need. The federal government has paid quite a bit of attention to this. There's an active FTC investigation into it that actually began under the Biden administration, was carried over into the Trump administration. I believe there are very few issues you can say that about. There's been activity at the congressional level, which recently passed the Somoza Act, a bipartisan piece of legislation aimed at really better understanding software licensing spend and restrictive licensing practices. The National Defense Authorization Act also called for a study of these licensing agreements within the Department of Defense to ensure that the department's better set up for realizing cost savings across its various offices. This bill's been enacted into law in 6 different jurisdictions already, including Missouri, Colorado, New Hampshire, Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio. It's actually currently sitting on the desk of the governor of West Virginia, and it's live and being considered by about another half dozen state legislatures currently. It really is just a technology procurement good housekeeping bill, ensuring that the state isn't forced into a situation where it's being forced to choose between winners and losers among technology companies, and really decouple this issue so that the state can really make the best purchasing choice for its own needs. I'll finish by saying that this piece of legislation is one of the model legislation pieces for the Council of State Governments. It's also been endorsed by the Computer Communications Industry Association, the Alliance for Digital Innovation, NetChoice, and a handful of others. Thank you very much. Happy to answer anybody's questions if they have any.
Thank you very much, Mr. Drexel. Are there any questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none. Ms. Miller-Austin, do you have any wrap-up comments for today?
Thank you, through the chair, for the record. Honor Miller-Austin, I just want to thank the committee again for hearing the bill and appreciate your time.
Very well. Anything further? Seeing and hearing nothing further, that will conclude our business for today here at Senate Labor and Commerce. The Senate Labor and Commerce Committee will be taking a break for Easter, coming up at the last half of the week. So our schedule for next week will be posted on basis Thursday afternoon, but you can count on more talk of unemployment insurance trusts and compacts next week. So stay tuned. We are now adjourned at 2:43 p.m.